Hi, thanks for joining us on Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest on this podcast is Vincent Spano. Vincent is a film, stage, and television actor. He's also a film director and producer. Vincent has many, many film and TV credits, but he's best known for his roles in Baby It's You, Rumblefish, The Black Stallion Returns, Alive, City of Hope, and Law & Order Special Victims Unit. He currently has 5 films in post-production, including Wonderwell, which was Carrie Fisher's final project. Vincent, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. A few more films I want to mention that I particularly enjoyed making, that's for sure. One was Creator with Peter O'Toole, Oscar with Sylvester Stallone and Marissa Tomei and Chaz Palminteri, et cetera, et cetera. And Indian Summer was a lot of fun, too. We had a terrific cast, including the late Bill Paxton.
All right, everybody, look him up on IMDb and then start watching these movies because they are good ones. I went back and I watched Baby It's You a couple of weeks ago, and it was really good. It was really cute.
I just saw the end of it because I didn't sit through it, but they just honored John Sayles up at the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival, and they invited me to come up there and present him with the award that they were honoring him with, which was the Sierra Spirit Award. It was a wonderful experience. It was great to see, a theater packed full of people who had not seen the film, so it was a first experience for them. And then to have John there and myself, and we did a Q&A after. It was a great night.
Well, it is a classic film at this point.
Yeah, there's some really good lines in that movie.
Some good lots of stuff, scenes, lines, everything.
My favorite, I think, was, what did I say? There's three people in the world that matter: Jesus Christ, Frank Sinatra, and me.
What a way to get going.
Yeah, it was a great line.
Well, so, all right. So, how old were you when you filmed that?
I was 19.
19, okay. So, backtracking, how did you get started? How did you know you wanted to be an actor?
Well, I didn't know I wanted to be an actor when I was very young, but there were things that were happening in my experience that were sort of hinting at it. For example, sixth grade, they did a production of Mary Poppins. Now, I was in an elementary school, so that was the highest grade in that school, so we were the big production of the year. And it was literally like a classroom situation where, you know, the teacher would say, okay, this is the play we're going to do this year. I've decided this is what we're going to do. Who wants to be in it? You raise your hand. And I remember just raising my hand and going, I'll be in it. And, you know, and I guess I ended up getting the lead, Bert. You know, the male lead opposite Mary Poppins, the Dick Van Dyke role. And I just had a blast. I was totally comfortable on stage. I really enjoyed it. Again, just a solitary experience. Nothing that made me think, oh, I want to do this, or this could be a career or a life course. And then the next year in seventh grade, I think I joined the choir, and it was always fun to be a part of things. And they were going to do a production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and I ended up playing Charlie Brown. Again, just by probably raising my hand, saying, I'll try, you know, and probably a few guys raised their hands, and we sang a song, and the teacher said, okay, you be Charlie Brown. I said, okay. So again, experience, totally just singular experience. Then in eighth grade, things changed a little bit because I was in a different school. Those are all three different schools, by the way. I went to a lot of different schools. And in eighth grade, I was going to this really cool school on the Upper East Side of New York. And the first experience was one of the kids in the school named Matt Barry, who's now a casting director, you probably know, who was an actor for years. He was on a TV show. And it was the first time it was like our friend at school, who was our same age, was like on TV at night, and it was like the coolest thing in the world. And Matt went on to get a huge movie for that time, because he got a movie called, I think, Luna, that Bernardo Bertolucci directed.
Oh my goodness.
With Jill Clayburgh and him. It was about this relationship between a mother and her son, and the son's a heroin addict. It was very heavy. Now, funnily enough, I met with Bertolucci for that role. That would have been one of my first auditions before I was actually working. So Matt got the part. But anyway, what happened in eighth grade was I had a dear friend named Seth. He was like my best friend. And his mom had some idea about me. And she said, you should meet this manager and you should audition for her. And I was like, well, what does that mean? What does audition mean? And she said, you know, you like, maybe you sing a little song or you read a little something. Like, I said, okay. Because her son, my friend, had done some commercials when he was 7. Well, now we were 13. We were older. 7-year-old, a 13-year-old, completely different. So he had to renew his face with this manager. He hadn't done anything for years. So she wanted to bring him up to see her again and me. And it was one of these nights, I guess, where she had like a little open showcase thing where a lot of young people came in and sat in front of her and read something or sang something. It was quite a few people there. So her name was Barbara Jarrett. And she literally, eventually I would realize she had a catalog of clients. She had like babies, she had young people, older people, everything. But I don't know, again, I sang this little song. I sang Meet the Mets, which was the, you know, the jingle for the New York Mets, because I was a Met fan. That was the song I sang. And she handed me something to read, and I think it was a gasoline commercial or something. And I remember the look on her face, and she signed me immediately. Unfortunately, she didn't sign my friend.
Oh, ouch.
But it wasn't his dream anymore anyway. He was a musician. His father was a successful jazz musician. So he was following in his father's footsteps, and he was really focused on his saxophone playing. And he got into music and art, which was great. So I signed with her immediately, and I went on my first auditions. In fact, my first audition was the day I graduated eighth grade. So that same year, that same school year, I made my first sacrifice. I was, because, you know, it was a middle school, so we were seventh, eighth, and ninth graders who hadn't gone to high school yet. And because they were going to start high school in 10th grade. The most awarded student for the 9th grade was this brilliant kid who went to school, but I was the most awarded student for the 8th grade, which was really cool, because I guess I was always very academic in school. I had a strong comfort zone there. That's why I thought I truly was going to do something, you know, more along the lines of continued study. Like, I really thought I'd be a lawyer or something. I wanted to be, yeah, I was impressed by the romantic idea of being a lawyer that I saw on television back then, on Perry Mason and stuff. And I guess it was in my nature to express myself and to debate and to stand firm in my point of view, etc. Because I was on the debate team also in eighth grade, and we went to the final. I lost the final because my debate partner didn't have a rebuttal. I remember. Anyway, so my first sacrifice was, these were all my dear friends. I was going on to Stuyvesant High School in downtown New York for ninth grade, so I would never see them again, really, in this setting. And I had to leave early. And so it was like, it was symbolic of that first sacrifice. And I went to my first two auditions, and my mom took me. My mom, Terry, is awesome, and she was never a stage mom. She only took me to maybe a couple, few of my first meetings, and then I was on my own after that, forever. She really was very supportive of me moving forward with this and was never a stage mom. She got some perks out of it because eventually when I got movies, she would come and she on my first movie, she was my chaperone. She was there the whole time. So she got to be on location with me. The second movie, she didn't come. They assigned me someone who was a friend within the production. So, but she visited. So, anyway, that was the first taste of it. And then, believe it or not, on the day of my 14th birthday, I had an audition and I got my first job. And then my career started at the end of that month. My birthday is October 18th. I think the show, the job was like on October 29th. So the end of October 1976, that's when I started.
And you were on Broadway shortly after that.
It gets crazy. I just really good remembering these dates that were important to me, you know. And I remember that day, I shot this little, what do they call it? Industrial commercial.
Mm-hmm.
It's my first job. And that night there was an audition for a play downtown. And in all the makeup, I'd never had makeup on in my life. And I had this stuff on my face. And my mom said, don't worry, just leave it on. And we went downtown to this theater, the Henry Street Settlement. And I read for this play about, it was like a Jewish family story. And I got the part. So I got this play the same day of my first job. And then I started doing this play. While I was doing that play, there was a buzz about another play. And I had to learn the guitar. I had to play one song for this play. So I started working with a coach to learn how to play the guitar a little bit and how to sing this one song. It wasn't a musical, it was a drama, but my character sang one song on the guitar. You know, accompanied by guitar to impress my father in the story. And that worked out. I eventually got that. And that was the big one. That was the Shadow Box. And we shot... we shot that. We opened at the Long Wharf Theater in Connecticut early the next year. You know, it was a crazy time because I started school at Stuyvesant. I started ninth grade, and I was off to a good start, like September, October, November, just, and then after Christmas, the Shadowbox started rehearsals like a couple days after Christmas, like the 27th, so we were still all on vacation, but then I didn't show up for like 2 weeks after the school year started.
So you missed 2 weeks of school.
I missed 2 weeks of Stuyvesant, which is almost, it's like a baseball team that's, you know, 15 games out of first place, you know, with a month left in the season. It take a miracle to catch back up and actually get first place. So that was the beginning of my academic struggle, where I had always excelled, but it was a worthwhile sacrifice.
So you'd always been obviously an incredible student, which must have been a big part of your identity.
It was. You know, I was always in the IGC classes. I took that seventh grade I was telling you about, I was in New Jersey, and whatever those tests are you take, I was like one of the highest grade, I got one of the highest marks on the East Coast, I remember. So, you know, It seemed to be a path of, you know, furthering my academic, you know, furthering my education and honing my skills at something that, you know, I could use my brain power for. But it seemed that God said, no, you're going to use your childlike, your childlikeness to go and play pretend for a living and your imagination. I was like, okay, that's cool, because I always felt I was an artist too inside. You know, I always loved art classes. They were always my favorite, you know, in school. And we even had a music class when I went to that, in eighth grade, the Clinton program it was called. And I remember the music class was the best. I loved everything creative, any way to express, even writing. I loved writing. we had a little newspaper at that school. I was a part of the, you know, I was on the staff of the newspaper. So what happened was the shadow box opened in Long Wharf, at the Long Wharf Theater in Connecticut, New Haven, Connecticut. And so the only way to get out there was some of the cast members rented a car. I was a kid. I was 14. So, you know, I would go with them and I pitched in whatever, you know, to pay for the rental car. But, you know, there was a lot of time missed at school, you know, because we had to drive out there every day or whenever we had shows, and certainly for matinees and stuff. Well, then we got picked up for Broadway.
Oh my God, that must have been amazing.
I didn't really understand it. You know, I had an idea of what, you know, what it meant, but, you know, the other actors were actors, and they understood what it meant to go to Broadway. So,
life-changing.
So in early 77, it was March, we opened on Broadway. And it was one of the best critically received plays, but again, it was a, you know, it was a heavy, heavy drama about death. It takes place at a hospice. So it was tough to get, you know, audiences in there. And it didn't look good. Mm. It was written by Michael Christopher, and all of a sudden, we got news that he won the Pulitzer Prize for the play.
Get out! That's crazy.
So the audience grew. And then we got 5 Tony nominations, and the audience grew. And then we won Best Play and Best Director. There were 3 other nominations for supporting actors, wonderful actors in our cast. We didn't win those, but we got Best Play and Best Director. So we were the drama on Broadway, and now we pack the house every night.
And you're 14, and this is your first show.
14, first show. Well, second show, really.
Second show, technically.
The show downtown.
That's right, okay.
And not only that, then we moved to a bigger theater. We moved from the Marasco, which is gone now. It was one of the theaters that had to be torn down to, you know, renovate Times Square. You know, that was Giuliani's choice. You know, in retrospect, I see now what he did was he really did clean up the area. But they felt that was the first step to put the Marriott hotel right there in the middle of Times Square, and I think they tore down 3 theaters to do it. So the Marasco is gone now, but at the time we were there, we started there, loved it. But then we moved to the L'Enfantaine, so we moved to a bigger theater, and it was fun. So I stayed in the show about 9 months, and I was the senior cast member. Everybody else had left. I was the only original cast member. And then from there, I went right into another show called Runaways that Elizabeth Swatos was workshopping. And there was a young actress, a little 12-year-old skinny little girl who was in that show too. We became really close friends. Her name was Diane Lane.
Get out. Oh my God.
So Elizabeth had Diane and I. Unfortunately, the story doesn't go very well. Elizabeth, they were paying us like $75 a week down at the PAP to do this workshop, and we were creating it for her. And that wasn't cutting it, you know? I mean, and so I auditioned for other things. Well, she had strictly forbidden us to audition for other things, as if she had the right.
Yeah, I was going to say, who gets to do that?
And I got a movie. And I had to go and tell her that I was going to be doing this movie, but it was in the future. It wasn't right away. I could still do the show. But she literally, she threw me out in front of everybody. After I'd been in part of this workshop for 2 or 3 months, she just threw me out in front of everybody, like that I had, you know, committed, you know.
Treason.
I was treasonous. So I never got to open downtown. But I'm certainly, I'm credited in the, if you look at the book, I'm credited. I had a different name. They made me change my name back then, by the way. Those 2 shows, or the 3 shows, where I was Vincent Stewart.
Stewart? Now, why Stewart?
They felt that you had to get away from anything ethnic sounding. I don't know why. I mean, Pacino and De Niro were ripping it up. I don't know why they thought it was limiting.
Interesting. People are facing that conversation now, still.
Well, I turned it around immediately, thanks to a producer. I'll tell you that story, but I just got rid of that. And so all my films were always billed as Spano. But in the original Runaways book, if you look, it'll credit me, Vincent Stewart, as having contributed one of the pieces. So what happened was I did finally, that movie, this was kind of later in that year, 77. So I did my first, I did get that movie, and I did it in early 78. Diane, she got to open downtown. She had a wonderful part in the show. She got a lot of attention. She got her first movie, which was Little Romance with Laurence Olivier. Again, she could have opened on Broadway. Runaways went to Broadway. She could have opened on Broadway. Elizabeth kicked her out of the show and wouldn't let her open on Broadway.
Because she got a movie.
She then went on to, you know, put her foot down about how she was so disgusted at the outside world trying to commercialize her show and commercialize her kids. And she said, there was a quote, I'll never forget it. She said, they've already stolen our John Travolta and Brooke Shields lookalikes.
Oh, great. That's what you are.
And then, but it was like so hypocritical in a way. I don't mean, look, Liz, is, God rest her soul, she's gone now. Oh, so, man. But I'm telling you, it's funny. I just learned so much so young about, you know, what this business is about.
Well, and human nature, I think, too. And the business.
So I worked with, I mean, Gordon Davidson, God rest his soul now, too. He's passed. You know, Gordon directed The Shadowbox. He's one of the nicest people in the world. I mean, everybody loved him.
Gosh.
So Gordon Davidson was the artistic director at the Mark Taper Forum, but he was in New York at that time directing The Shadowbox. So there I had this experience with this amazing man who was like a father figure. And then I went to this other show with this woman who was like, you know, this female Hitler. And it was, I'm sorry. It was rough, man. She was intense. And everybody probably, you know, still praises her for her artistic talent. You know, her musical talent and her talent to bring together a bunch of young kids and get the best out of us. But the truth is, you know, she used us. We created the show. We would literally all share and tell stories, and she'd take notes and then come back with a piece that she wrote. So we were all part of the workshop. And it was an interesting experience for me because it was my first real heartbreak. I mean, that was painful when she kicked me out of the show. We all were pretty close. Can you imagine how close we were?
I can, and that's crazy hard.
Yeah. So I was learning a lot very fast.
And how old are you now? Still 14?
15, I turned maybe? 15 in late 77, and then so I got my first movie. So I was doing my first movie at 15.
So meanwhile, what about school? How's that going? Are you just kind of... Was homeschooling a thing back then?
A miracle happened. One of the teachers at Stuyvesant, his name was Jack Ergang. He was a bit of a folk hero at school. He was kind of a legend. He taught history and economics. And his economics course, he did a course review at the end of the trimester, in which he filled all the chalkboards with everything they had gone over the trimester, and he would do the entire review by going from one board to the next board to the next board in the, whatever, the 35 minutes of class, whatever. And kids would just pack the room and take pictures and record. I mean, he was a legend, and they would cheer at the end of it, but he was famous for it. So he was a remarkable man, and he was a theater goer. He loved to go to all the shows. He'd go to the opera. He'd go to the concerts in New York. He'd go to the Broadway shows. He was a connoisseur. So he went to see the Shadowbox, and he saw in the program that I was a student at Stuyvesant. So he asked to meet with me at school. He asked me to go up to his room. I said, well, who is this guy? Because he didn't teach any of my classes. I was just a freshman. So I go to meet him, and he says, how you doing? I saw the show. I really enjoyed it, blah, blah, blah. And how you doing in school? I said, not very good. He said, I had a feeling. He came to the theater and tutored me backstage.
Are you kidding?
And then he didn't have a family of his own. He had never gotten married or anything like that. He was just a man of really just kind of like his teaching, his work, and the arts, art appreciation, I'd say. And so we adopted him into our family. And he was always at all our, you know, holiday gatherings and everything. So Jack was awesome. So it was Jack who came to help tutor me, and by the skin of my teeth, I passed ninth grade.
So this is so interesting because, you know, we're about the same age, and I know when I was in high school, I did a formal independent study, which meant I was just sort of not attending school for half the year, and I was doing my own thing, but I had to report to somebody, and it was all set up. But I don't know how common, you know, alternate arrangements were back then. I suppose it depends on the school, but like there's a lot of laws in place now that probably weren't in place back then in the 70s and 80s.
Probably.
Because you should have had a tutor on set already. Like production should have arranged for that.
You mean on the play?
Yeah.
Well,
and then in movies.
Certainly in the movies, I had a tutor. Because I got my first film, and that was during the school year of the 10th grade. But we had already made the transition. After I struggled to get out, to get through ninth grade, then I went to a professional school for 10th grade. It was correspondence. So everything was already pre-planned. So they could easily communicate to the tutor, these are the books he needs. Or they actually sold them. So you can buy them, take them with you. And this is what he has to do every week. Everything was completely outlined.
Basically the equivalent of what an online school would be today.
Correct.
Yeah.
Even though I paid for this private school and it was correspondence, because in 10th grade I did my first two movies, I couldn't keep up. I still couldn't keep up. And I chose, they literally said, well, you can do all this work and finish 10th grade, or you can do it again. And I just chose to retake it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a failure. It was a incompletion.
Yeah.
So I took 10th grade again at the same school. You would think that the correspondence would have helped, but it was so hard with the timing. And maybe the system wasn't in place properly back then. You know, if you really think about it, I'd always been academically strong. I probably should have been given a pass on 10th grade. So my first one was called The Double MacGuffin. It was directed by Joe Camp, who had directed the Benji films. This was different for him because, you know, now he wanted to break out of his G mold and do like a PG or PG-13. So it was about a bunch of young boys at a prep school. And we get involved with this murder mystery. And it was really fun. It was exciting. I was a New York City kid, and now I was in you know, Savannah and Atlanta, Georgia, and Charleston, South Carolina. It was very cool to get out of New York City and have an experience in another part of the country, because I'd really pretty much never been out of New York. You know, maybe I visited Florida once or something. So on that film, Mom was my chaperone.
Aww.
Which was great.
Yay, Mom.
Yeah, Mom got to go. Then my second film was a really cool film that still to this day, a lot of people are big fans of this movie called Over the Edge. It was my second film, Matt Dillon's first. It's considered one of the best teenaged angst films ever made. Jonathan Kaplan directed it. We had a great time. That was primarily over the summer, so there was no tutoring or concern with school issues. And then what happened was, well, I retook 10th grade, had some really cool fellow classmates at that school. It was called Lincoln Square Academy.
So you re-enrolled in a standard school?
No, this is the retaking of 10th grade. After I finished Over the Edge, I had to retake 10th grade, and I was still at the professional school, Lincoln Square Academy.
Okay.
So a lot of my classmates were other working young actors.
That's very cool.
Like Robbie Benson, Andrew McArdle from Annie. Excuse me. Robbie Benson, Andrew McArdle, Lawrence Fishburne, who had just done Apocalypse. I remember Lawrence came and said, "Yeah, I just did a movie for Francis Ford Coppola." I said, "Really? A cool man." He says, "Yeah, I got a Polaroid. This is my death scene." I said, "Oh man, that's intense." I said, "What's it about?" He said, "Well, it's kind of about these guys who take this boat up this river in Vietnam and everything."
I'm freaking out over here. You can't see me freaking out because this is a podcast, but I'm freaking out. Oh man.
And Jimmy Baio was in my class. He was Scott Baio's cousin. Scott didn't go to that school, but you know, I came up with all these guys. And it was really fun, you know. It was a fun time. Well, then things shifted. Then I went into that awkward age of becoming 16. And work wasn't as easy, wasn't as forthcoming. You kind of get, you grow really tall with this baby face and you're kind of awkward looking and stuff. But the one thing I did do was I did a terrific play that was supposed to go to Broadway also. And I was the lead in that play. It was a great play. Some amazing people came to see it because of our cast member. The guy who played my father was Richard Bright. You know, he was in The Godfather. He plays Al Thierry. Anyway, I'm not remembering his name properly. But anyway, he had a wonderful part in The Godfather, the first two films. And so he was friends with everybody. So Duvall came to see it. Pacino came to see it. It was a small little play, but it was so great. And they wanted to bring it to Broadway, but they wanted to blow it up. They wanted to get Frank Corsaro, who had directed a big successful play on Broadway with a, you know, that also had an Italian-American theme to it. They wanted to bring in John Travolta to play my role. And the director just said no. And he had the right to put his foot down, so nothing ever happened with it. But again, it was really a blessing. I was like 3 for 3. 3 shows I had been in were destined for Broadway. You know, Shadowbox went to Broadway, Runaways went to Broadway, not that I did it, and this one, A Barbershop in Pittsburgh, was destined for Broadway too, but it just didn't, it just got, it got kind of put into a turnaround, let's say.
But this happens a lot, actually. This happens more than people know, because if they don't hear about it, they didn't know it happened, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of glad it didn't go anywhere, because frankly, you know, I was the perfect age. John's older than me. I mean, he was a, you know, a huge star back then, and I loved him. Saturday Night Fever was the bomb. But I was more right for the part because it was about a 16-year-old and I was 16. And so I didn't think it was right. And I was glad it didn't go anywhere. I didn't want it to go anywhere without me. So it was truly a wonderful play. And Al Pacino, I remember he said to Richie, he says, "You tell that kid if he ever meets me, you tell him, hey, he tells me I was the kid in that play that you saw."
Oh!
So Pacino was a fan when I was a kid.
Well, and, that's a trough, though. What you're talking about is something that the kids really struggle with now. You hit that sort of 16, 17 thing. You're not old enough to compete with the 18 to 22s who are going to snatch those parts away from you because they can work longer hours. And, you know, they're more mature, let's be honest, in most cases, too. There's other reasons to work with older kids. And yet, you're taller, and you don't look like a 14-year-old anymore.
It's a strange period. And it was hard because basically money ran out. Couldn't afford the private school. So now I couldn't go back to Stuyvesant. You can't, like, go back to Stuyvesant. Once you're out of there, you're out because you're way behind on their curriculum. So for 11th grade, I had to go to regular old public school that was based on where I lived, like my zip code. And that was the hardest thing in the world because I had been exposed to a whole world that none of these kids had. You know, I was a young adult, and you know, I'd experienced some success. I'd experienced being in the public eye, and now it was all taken away, and it was really, really hard. I I didn't excel in school anymore because I was like so depressed. I remember it was a tough time, like 11th grade, 17 years old, really tough time. I got one job, which was a soap opera. I did Search for Tomorrow, which is gone now, but I tell you, I did Search for Tomorrow for a couple of months. I didn't like it. I was spoiled. I had done movies. Double MacGuffin was in the South. We were outside on location. I loved it. Over the Edge, we were in Colorado. You know, we were Matt and Michael and Tommy, and we were out in the world. We were in this place that was so different from where we come from, you know, the mountains and, you know, being a mile high in Denver and shooting in the outskirts of Denver. And now I was in the studio all day, you know, it was all fake lighting and, you know, it was all like interior and it was like a job, you know, you had to be there every day early and, you know, filming was like, you never know, maybe you're shooting nights, so you have a different schedule, you start later in the day, but, so I did not like the soap opera experience as a kid. But at least I was working, I did something, and thank God I got through 11th grade, and then that's when things started to shift a little. I found out about a school in New York City called City as School. It still exists, and it was like God had designed it for me. You got credits for doing internship work outside of the school. You still had to show up at the school for certain state required things like mathematics or whatever, literature, whatever, but you could get a big part of your credits by looking out into the city and finding an internship work that gave you life experience. Mm. And I was so blessed. I had a friend who hooked me up with an internship at a professional photography studio that shot, it was commercial photography. It wasn't really fashion. We were shooting like, you know, liquor bottles, but top contracts,
yeah.
Big Chanel, you know, perfume, all this stuff. So I was basically the second assistant at this photography studio. And I got on really well with the photographer. He was a great guy. And so now I'm a senior, 12th grade, City as School. I'm in my fourth different high school that took 5 years.
And you're so smart. That must have been like very galling at a certain level. Like,
but how does this happen? I got to you? That diploma, man. I got that diploma. I was a little older than you're supposed to be, right? Because I graduated at 18 instead of 17.
Lots of us graduated at 18.
And that summer, I was auditioning for The Black Stallion Returns. And the biggest part of that, well, I don't know. First of all, I got a lot of sun because I wanted to darken my skin. I was going to be auditioning for an Arabian prince, you know. So I got a lot of sun. So I darkened my skin. My hair was long, which was great. It was nice and long. I got some clothes that looked like you would look if you were a very wealthy Arabian prince. But the key was to ride the horse. And I was a city kid. So the way I figured that out was I went out to Forest Hills, Queens. I think it was called the Forest Hills Riding Academy. And I would take lessons there, but then I couldn't pay for them anymore. So I made a deal. I said, listen, can I help groom the horses and clean the horses in exchange for lessons? They said, okay. At the same time, I had put my applications in for college, for film school. And my three top choices were School of Visual Arts, downtown New York, California Institute of the Arts in Valencia, California, and State University of New York, Purchase. Now, the reason, first of all, California Institute of the Arts was a whole new life change. I'd have to completely move out to California, be totally away from New York. So that really wasn't jiving. School of Visual Arts, great, but it's like 23rd Street, New York City. I'd probably still have to live at home. I did not want to live at home anymore.
No.
State University of New York, Purchase, north of New York City, 45 minutes out, dorm rooms, I could get out of my house, still be near New York, And SUNY Purchase was designed in a very unique way. They had literally three buildings that were the different departments in the film program. They had a film building, which was all the film students and the film equipment. They had an actors building with all the performers. And they had a tech building for all the guys and all the men and women that want to work behind the scenes. They want to be cinematographers. They want to be production designers. So you had like a studio. It was like a little studio where if you were in the film building, those people in those other two buildings, they need you.
Yeah,
those actors need films to be in, and the techies need, and the production heads need projects to work on. So I was so excited about State University of New York Purchase. That was my first choice. Well, God willing, I got accepted all three because I had, you know, made some Super 8 movies. I got my Super 8 camera when I was doing the Shadow Box. I got my first camera, and I had my first experience making little films. So I had, you know, I had little scripts I had written. I had storyboards. I had photographs I had taken. I had Super 8 films I had made. So it was kind of a slam dunk. I can see now how, you know, I would have accepted me too, because I, as young as I was, I had experience already. So I chose SUNY, and there I was writing the I borrowed money to write the check out for my registration, just for my orientation, right? And then I was making deals to ride the horse, you know, to get the horse lessons. And then came my big final audition. I had the audition, I had the screen test, but now I had to go, they flew me, of all places, they flew me to Valencia to ride the horse for my test.
That's hilarious.
Which is where
California
Studio
is. It's not that far from here.
So I would subsequently learn later that I already had the part, but I didn't know. And so I was terrified when I flew on that plane across the country, because I'm like, I gotta ride the horse. I can't fall off the horse. I gotta look really good on the horse.
Gotta look like I've been riding horses all my life.
I didn't know I had the part, but I found out later that day. It was incredible. I said, oh, can I call my mom and tell her? Yeah. So I got that part, and you know, this is an important part of my story, because the day I was supposed to show up for orientation at college at SUNY Purchase is the day I got on a plane and flew to Italy to begin this six-month adventure of a lifetime playing Raj, the Arabian prince in The Black Stallion Returns, and being welcomed into Francis Coppola's Zoetrope family. And that, those are my beginnings. And that was the beginning. I mean, you know, I turned 19 in Morocco while we were shooting shortly after. And that film, as soon as I got home, I screen tested for Baby It's You, and I got Baby It's You. And while I was doing Baby It's You, oh, I had to make a decision. I also screen tested. While I was doing The Black Stallion Returns, I did my own screen test on set. I organized it from short ends, and I asked everybody to help me. And right before we went to lunch one day, I did a little screen. I took off my Arabian garb and threw on this proper, you know, 1950s costume I scraped together as best I could from borrowing little pieces here and there. And I did an audition for The Outsiders. And I got both. Francis offered me The Outsiders, Francis and Fred Roos, the producer, my friend. And they both started on the same day. And I had to decide which one to do. And I decided to do Baby It's You. Now, obviously, The Outsiders was a much bigger commercial success. We know the actors from that all blew up. But, you know, Baby It's You was just something I couldn't say no to. It was just so well written. And John was such a great young director. So I didn't get to do The Outsiders. Now, you can imagine, Francis Coppola was one of my heroes. I had pictures of him on my wall when I was a kid. When I was making my little Super 8 movies, I had my favorite filmmakers and posters up on the walls. And one of them was Francis. So to say no to Francis was to say, oh my God, have I lost my opportunity to work with my hero, you know, my mentor. Well, right after Baby It's You, I got a phone call, and Francis asked me to do Rumblefish.
Mm.
So I got to work with him anyway. And Rumblefish was an incredible experience. So from that age of from turning 18 to 19 in Morocco, from the day I started shooting Black Stallion till the finish of Rumblefish, I had put those three movies in the can in less than a calendar year. And that was the true beginning of my film career.
Wow. What an amazing story.
That's my story.
I love it. I love it. And I love all the school details because I think people can't understand how challenging it is to be a young actor and to be a truly working professional and how long those hours are and to be somehow also managing school, which is kind of full time for most kids, you know? Like that's
it
tough.
It was so hard that I think it caused a certain post-traumatic stress in me for years. I am now over it. But I, for years and years, I mean for decades after that, I had the Sunday blues. And I always attributed it partly to, that was the night before, after the weekend, I had to go back into school and struggle because I was so far behind.
Because there was no way.
Never catch up. So, another wonderful little moment that happened during that struggling period was Rocky came out in 77?
That's what I think, yeah. Sounds right.
Or 70, I can't
Six?
Remember.
It could have been 76. It could have
76.
Been. Yeah.
Rocky came out in 76. It was absolutely my favorite movie when I saw it. I loved it. I had the poster on my wall. And I loved the music. And Gonna Fly Now, the music, you know, the theme song. My mother used to come in and play it for me on my record player to help me get up.
Aww.
Because it was so hard to get up and face this going to school. So I remember Gonna Fly Now was my theme song. And my mom was, you know, she was the greatest. She is the greatest. So, yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because and spotlight that because it really was an unbelievable challenge. That's why some kids go, they go to high school, like, and they do their 4 years and they're done. For me, that diploma was so symbolic of a triumph. And if you think about it, I never got to go to college. College was replaced with incredible life experience. I mean, you could go to film school or you could go work on some of the best movies you can imagine.
Of the generation.
With one of the greatest filmmakers that ever lived.
These, you know? These movies are still just iconic.
I mean, Francis didn't direct Black Stallion, but Robert Dalva did, who edited the first Black Stallion. He was nominated for the first Black Stallion. He was a brilliant editor. Now he was exploring directing. The cinematographer was Carlo De Palma, who would go on to shoot 12 of Woody Allen's movies. You know, the sound man was the Academy Award winning Nat Boxer who had done Apocalypse. I was around the best of the best. The best of the best. And then to go on and work with John Sayles, who would be the independent hero for all these decades since, in Baby It's You, in such a wonderfully written piece. With two unknown actors whose first films, who had their first films also in Baby It's You, was Matthew Modine and Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey, they even cut his little part. So he's actually in there. You can see his face if I point him out. But he had like one little thing with a couple of lines and they cut it out. So, but that was his first film. So this was an amazing time. Nick Cage, that was one of his first big breaks, Rumblefish. Chris Penn, Matt Dillon. Matt was kind of on his way. He was doing really well. You know, he'd already done Tex. And of course, he did The Outsiders before Rumblefish. So Matt was doing great. But, you know, Mickey Rourke. So, it was an incredible time. And from there on, I didn't have the pressure of school. I could just, like, live in peace and work. But, I mean, of course, there's tons of new challenges that come up and struggles, that's for sure. But I survived that period.
Well, and I think I've thought about this a lot because of my own kid. You know, she was done with school early. She finished at 16 and may or may not ever go to college. We'll see. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, the education, the true education that she's gotten working with, again, some of the best people in the field, you're not going to find that at any school. That is not available in any college program anywhere. And so, you know, you get your education where you do.
I agree. And I only look back as it all being a blessing. In fact, I attribute some of my, maybe what you would call natural ability as an actor, as a creator, to the fact that my childhood was so crazy and rocky between two parents getting divorced, you know, early on. You know, divorce was not common in the 60s. And my parents divorced, and so I was back and forth between parent and parent in this school. I mean, I told you the high school journey, but that wasn't the beginning of that chaos in school. There were 13 years of school in America, right? Kindergarten plus 12 grades. I think I went to 12 different schools over those for those 13 grades. And it took me an extra year, as I told you. So I think that that little boy who has to suddenly be thrown into a new environment and fit in and make peace and make friends and, you know, and be in a family where there's a lot of strife and want to keep the peace and not have problems, you learn to be what you have to be in that moment. You learn to make it work and be who you got to be. And I think that was part of my training without realizing it, of how to pretend whatever it took to create what you want to create in the moment, to get along, to fit in. You know, Tom Cruise talks about that a little, I think, because he was from a military family. So again, he was relocated a lot, him and his sister, he talks about it. Again, you're going into these new groups of kids, and kids are tough, man. And you got to fit in. And you want to be popular. You want to be important. And I remember the one thing, if you'd say anything about me in school, if I remember back in eighth grade, I got along with everybody. There were groups that just didn't like each other. Like, you know, like they just, it was oil and vinegar, you know. I got along with everybody. I got along with the nerdy kids. I got along with the cool kids. I got along with the jocks. I got along with the intellectuals. That was just who I was.
I think a lot of actors that I know personally, they are incredibly good at reading people. Like, they are good reads of people. And that's kind of an important thing to be able to reverse engineer if you're going to be being a character, if you're going to be, you know, externalizing an internal condition for people, is to understand how that looks and how that works and what that means. You know, what are you seeing, you know, when somebody's raising their eyebrow this way, what does that really mean? And correct. And so people who grow up in situations that are a bit rockier or a bit, in some way, that make it necessary for them to be paying very fine attention to subtle details about people and tones of voice and facial expressions and body language, that can be a real asset for an actor.
I agree. I don't think it's a conscious thing. I also credit my exploration and interest in spirituality as I got older with finding ways to appreciate everything and to see the blessings in everything. That's a tough, tough road for a lot of people. There's a lot of anger and resentment and regret because they haven't embraced the gratefulness and the beauty of the journey and the road. So I think that is a later life experience that rounded me out. Thank God.
It's a big one. That's a really big one. This wraps part one of my conversation with Vincent Spano. Listen in next week for part two and Vincent's thoughts on training, auditions, longevity in Hollywood, what keeps him inspired, and much more. Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you enjoy this podcast, I'd love it if you'd leave a quick review on my iTunes page. More reviews help more people find me. If you need help figuring out just how to navigate the career of a young actor, buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And for one-on-one coaching that can save you literally thousands of dollars and months and sometimes years of wasted time, book an hour's consultation with me over Skype or in LA. Just go to BonnieJWallace.com and click on the consultation page. For about the same price of an hour with an acting coach, you can get peace of mind and a detailed action plan. would love to help you. Remember, the future belongs to those who believe in their dreams.